You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 16th of September 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, as Hungary attempts to quite literally hose down its migrant influx, Brazil is striking a markedly different tone by welcoming anyone who can make their way to its admittedly far-off shores. Will the generosity last, and how compatible might the policy be with the country's looming economic catastrophe? I'll ask my studio guests Oscar Guardiola Rivera and Ivor Gaber. Also ahead, the extraordinarily long audition process for the new face of Britain's political opposition is finally over. So how did veteran Labour firebrand Jeremy Corbyn fare in his first shouting match against the Conservative Prime Minister? Plus, a supposedly powerful right-wing publication has made more than a few enemies after sinking its teeth into Donald Trump. But just how much influence do these venerable news journals still have on America's increasingly unruly political circus? And later in the show, we will cast our gaze over the good, the bad, and the hopelessly hopeful contenders for the 2024 Olympics. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Ivor Gaber, journalist and journalism professor, and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, senior lecturer in law at Birkbeck University and author of What If Latin America Ruled the World. Welcome both back to the programme. We will start, as we have so often in recent weeks, with Europe's unceasing migrant crisis, but tonight with a South American angle. Brazil has taken a notably generous approach, offering Syrian refugees applying to its embassy in Beirut rite of passage. The appeal to refugees is not hard to discern. Better an economy class airline seat to a welcoming country than a rickety boat across a dark sea and a long walk to who knows where. More than 7,000 Syrian refugees are now in Brazil. Oscar, first of all, is this just a reflection of the fact that if you are further away from the crisis, you can afford to be more generous?
Well, in fact, it's a reflection of history. As you know very well, Latin America has a long history of receiving refugees, particularly during the 20th century. Thousands of refugees from Europe ended up in a Latin America that at the time was far more unstable than it is now. So it is not a surprise that Latin American countries such as Brazil, but also others, have offered to take them on. Mind you, it is also the fact that there is a strong Syrian community in many countries in Latin America. I myself learned to recognize as a political figure of the Latino in Latin America Yasser Arafat before Che Guevara when I was a child, since my neighbors were Syrian Lebanese.
Well, just to stay with you, Oscar, President Dilma Rousseff wrote a newspaper editorial this week recalling that more than 10 million Brazilians are descended from Syrians or Lebanese, not least, in fact, the vice president, Michel Temer. Yep. So she said there's a certain obligation to the refugees of Syria. She's not been terribly good at necessarily judging the national mood of late. She has popularity polls in double digits in a good week. Is she on the right track here?
Again, there is a historical argument that can be made. Having said that, I'm not sure most people in Brazil would be very interested in appearing as grand and generous as Dilma might want to make it, given the current woes in the country. But again, history does matter here, because if in the past Latin America was able to accommodate thousands of Europeans fleeing from World War II and the Spanish Civil War, these countries were far more unstable, and its economic destiny was far more uncertain back then. I'm sure it will be the same this time around.
Ivor Gaber, there's been some suggestion among recently arrived Syrians to Brazil, grateful though they are, that not an awful lot is being done for them once they're there. I mean, this is a question that is having to be addressed on a much greater scale by Germany in particular. But what Once you have offered a refugee a place of safety, what are your further obligations towards them? Not just if you're Brazil, but if you're anybody.
Well, I don't know the precise situation in Brazil, although let me just add a cynical wizened eye on the situation.
Please do.
That most of the people, I would guess, who are applying for refugee status, who know about the Brazilian offer, as we're seeing with those coming to Europe, are pretty middle-class, skilled, educated.
Oh, sure.
And given the state of the Brazilian economy, it doesn't seem a totally bad move to boost the quality of your workforce. So that's me being cynical. Obligations, well, I think, you know, it varies tremendously. There's the letter of the law and the spirit of the law. Hungary claims to be acting within the letter of the UN Convention on Refugees. But whether it's acting in the spirit of
Hungary keeps claiming, look, you're in Serbia, safe.
The UN, UNHCR says Serbia ain't safe for a number of reasons by their definition of safe. I do think this comes down to individual cultures in countries. I think South America does have obviously a long history of accepting refugees. My only perception would be Brazil's going through some pretty difficult times at the moment. And how welcoming can they be? This might just be seen as a distraction. Politicians have been known to have distractions when they're facing. So I suppose it's me being cynical. And I don't know what their obligations are. I just have a sense that political leaders whose popularity is down to the sort of figures you quote do often have another agenda on the run.
Oscar, there is, to invoke the beloved cliche, choppy waters ahead for the Brazilian economy. It is a demonstrable fact of history that at uncertain economic times, people tend to be less friendly than they otherwise might be towards new arrivals. Is that likely to make people in Brazil more or less accepting of more Syrian refugees?
Well, that's my fear. We have seen that happening already in Mexico. In fact, Mexicans, even very well-intentioned Mexicans, have been quick to warn President Peña Nieto that given the problems in the country, he shouldn't be doing this sort of offers. I suspect that something of the sort might happen elsewhere, possibly in Brazil. But again, as I pointed out, we do have a precedent, and the precedent of the 20th century leads us to think that even if economic choppy waters lie ahead, as you pointed out, those coming will accommodate. And in fact, you just pointed out that the vice president is, a descendant from Syrians, which goes to show the extremely, short time span in which migrants in South America can become quite influential.
Okay, well, we're going to look now at the UK, where today has seen the most significant rite of passage yet for the surprise new leader of the opposition Labour Party, the veteran left-wing troublemaker Jeremy Corbyn. Today was Corbyn's first appearance in his new role at Prime Minister's Questions, and that's the weekly ritual which is supposed to be a rigorous interrogation of the head of government, but which is more often sort of a custard pie fight without the custard pies, or a melodramatic bloodbath not readily distinguishable from the daytime chat shows it goes up against at noon on Wednesdays. Corbyn did today have other ideas. He put to David Cameron questions emailed to him by actual voters. Ivor, what did you make of the tactic?
Oh, it was rather clever, wasn't it? I mean, it was predictable, but, Marie, it now turns out from London, asked a question about housing. It's rather difficult that Jeremy Corbyn posed her question. A little difficult for David Cameron to lay into Maria and say, you don't know what you're talking about, you silly old what's it. So that was very good. I think it was very interesting. I've got a but coming.
Please.
Firstly, the point of Prime Minister Question Time is to hold the government accountable. Now, Marie knows a lot about housing, I've got no doubt. But actually, what's required is something a bit more forensic. And I think what Corbyn might learn, and here's a bit of free advice for me, is to have the Marie question ready, but then to have some pretty pointed follow-ups.
Because there were no follow-ups today. I mean, I thought it was a nice idea myself, but to me, it ended up after three or four of them just looking like a nice old gentleman asks the Prime Minister, to share his thoughts with the country.
Well, it actually reminded me of, I was thinking back to the days when phone-in programmes first started, and the host's job was not to pin down whoever was in the studio, but simply to convey what Arthur from Birmingham was thinking. And I thought Jeremy Corbyn would make quite a good phone-in host. But having said all that, we've got no question that Prime Minister's Question Time has attracted a lot of adverse attention. I have to say, I think the viewing figures will be bigger in the past when they were going hammering it away, when it's a bit softer.
Now, on that exact point, this was Jeremy Corbyn's whole thing, that it was going to be a new kind of Prime Minister's Questions. He was cleaving to this conventional wisdom that the public are turned off by rowdy, brawling PMQs. I think that's rubbish. I think it's one of those things people say when they're asked because they know it's the sort of thing they should say. It's like when you ask sports fans about violence in football games and they always go, oh, it's terrible, it's dreadful. Everyone loves a good punch-up. When it actually happens, you can see all the people laughing in the stands.
Of course we do. And actually, I've seen Corbyn doing follow-ups, and he's quite good at it. So, I do think that we will see some fireworks later on. I do agree with you that what he's doing is quite clever. There are two things you can do in politics. You can go, be arrogant, I'm going to win. You can be adversarial, or you can try and change the rules of the game. And he's trying to do the latter, which is quite interesting. It goes better with his persona. He's not an adversarial persona, though, as I said before, he is quite adept. My other source here is Sir Anthony Seldon, who's knows, the biographer of prime ministers, who knows better than most, and he has pointed out how articulate and adept Corbyn can be. Mind you, the best follow up was given by the 20-year-old member of parliament from the SNP,
Mary Black.
Mary Black did it brilliantly by pointing out that Mary and others were real, while the government keeps inventing people.
I do recall. You remind me of that even if this works for Corbyn in terms of popularity and so forth, I'm reminded of a previous leader of the opposition. It was a Conservative at the time, called William Hague, who was up against and became Foreign Secretary, so I'm sure our listeners were familiar with him, was up against Tony Blair, and he didn't do very well electorally, and when he'd stepped down he was being interviewed and said, well, Mr. Hague, but you used to out debate Tony Blair week in, week out. You got the better of him at Prime Minister's Question Time.
He was very good at PMQs,
to which really Hague's response was, and fat lot of good it did me. So, I do think we journalists might tend to exaggerate the importance of this. It's good. I tell you what, it's good for the morale of the troops. And I think that's really important for Corbyn, because most Labour MPs are profoundly and deeply depressed at the moment. Very few of them supported him. And I think it's good for morale of the troops.
What do you think we learnt today, if anything, about how the Conservatives plan to handle him at PMQs? Because obviously, if you're David Cameron, who is the proper eaten, educated toff that he is, he can't come across looking like an upper class bully. I thought it was noticeable that when Corbyn walked into the chamber, there was no barracking or jeering or ironic applause from the Conservative benches, clearly under instruction not to do so.
It's an interesting question how long they can stay under instruction, because deeply and profoundly, they think this guy is a wild lefty who's a real threat to the country. They were on absolute best behaviour today. Of course, it did break out towards the end.
Yeah.
And I think they will not be as restrained over the weeks to come.
That's precisely why I said that we'll see fireworks later on, because actually the behaviour of the Conservative bench was quite studied. It was almost manufactured. A couple of, tricky questions put by backbenchers and so on, so as to allow the right-wing Prime Minister David Cameron to say a couple of things against the so-called left-wing.
I thought he coped very well with the question about the difficulty the Isle of Wight Zoo is having importing a tiger.
The tiger was brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant.
We're talking about major issues here, but let me just say, trying to break the rules of spin, if you like, the new spin is no spin. Quite clearly, Jeremy Corbyn needs not just a spin doctor, he needs a very good spin doctor who doesn't look like he's working the magic on Corbyn, which he'll need a little bit
of. Let us wait for the numbers. I want to see if more people tuned in for
I rather suspect today was the best rated PMQs in a while.
But also whether he will continue with the same strategy, which I suspect he will not, because
that is from a low bar.
Yeah, I mean, look, as an ex-BBC political journalist, the viewing figures for this programme is probably more of us making the programme than watching it. But the real test is what clip do they use on the big news shows tonight? Because that's where the audiences are. So when BBC and ITV run PMQs, Prime Minister's Question Time, we'll see what it does and we'll see what it does to the polling figures. Watch this space.
Just a final thought on PMQs from each of you. I'll ask you first, Oscar. Do you think it's basically a good idea as it is? Do you like it? I mean, I know it often baffles people from the United States, where, of course, the president is not obliged to show up at Congress and get yelled at once a week. But I actually quite enjoy it. I think I like the idea of having a leader who can think on his feet or her feet and can answer questions and can respond and can adjust. I think it's actually quite a useful test.
I like it. I like the idea. This shows the two people, the two characters, but also, and I think this was very, very clever from Jeremy Corbyn's side, bringing other people into the conversation, real people. As you pointed out very well, Cameron could not go lash out against real people.
It would have been brilliant if he had, though, if he just said, well, Mary's clearly an idiot.
That will come.
Ivor, what do you think of it as an institution? As you said, you had experience in actually dealing with it up close. Well, do you think it serves a purpose?
Wizened old hack again. In my day, Prime Minister's Question Time was different. It was twice a week, Tuesday, Thursday, and it was only 15 minutes long, and that was great theatre. Because with the best will in the world for the tiger in the Isle of Wight, the half an hour begins to drag a bit. It was really top-notch entertainment in them days. 15 minutes twice a week. Now it's a bit laboured, if you'll excuse the pun. It's fun. We enjoy it. I've just come from a day-long conference looking at what happened at the general election and the polls and how they got it wrong. Nobody ever asks a question because they get 0%. How important to you was the Prime Minister's performance in your voting decision? Because, you know, this is for us sad nerds, I'm afraid.
Well, we sad nerds are going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, with Ivor Gaber and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Coming up next, the declining or otherwise influence of two great American current affairs journals and the next destination of the Olympic flame.
Monocle loves books. We love them so much that we have our very own books team in partnership with our friends at Gestalten in Berlin. We've already launched the muscular and handsome Monocle Guide to Better Living and the Monocle Guide to Good Business too, plus the London, New York, Hong Kong and Tokyo titles in our new hardback City Guide series. And now there's the giant Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes that's packed with inspiring residences and practical advice for making your ideal and welcoming residence. Monocle's books offer a world of new experiences between the covers, whether you're staying at home or seeking new adventures. See our full lineup of well-turned-out titles at monocle.com and on the shelves of all great bookstores.
You're welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Ivor Gaber and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. In the 2003 film Shattered Glass, a dramatising of the unmasking of a fabulising journalist at the New Republic, one character describes the venerable liberal current affairs periodical as the in-flight magazine of Air Force One. While this seems unfeasibly pompous even by the standards of American journalism, there is no doubt that New Republic and its conservative counterpart, National Review, are important. But are they still as much so as they would prefer to think? Ivor, I'll ask you first. National Review, which is the reason we're talking about this, is that National Review has run a big piece bemoaning, not unreasonably, the Donald Trump phenomenon by Jonah Goldberg. It starts with the interesting phrase, "Dear reader, if there's any of you left." Is he being unduly pessimistic?
I don't know the answer to that question because I think American journalism is slightly different to British journalism, which I'm more familiar with.
It's very different to British journalism.
I do think that the issue of whether he should have gone out and said Donald Trump is not part of the club, which is essentially what he said, raises the issue of how they now see themselves. Where is their market? And my suspicion is, and they're following in New Republic, that their market is no longer in the wizened old gentleman in Wyoming who has it delivered by post.
It's exactly that. It's the club. And the National Review, it's always been the standard bearer of the patrician American right. Oscar, is its problem now that basically the Republican Party has been more or less taken over by its Yahoo wing?
Well, something is really clearly happening in American politics that is not just the Yahoo wing. Look at the fact that Ted Cruz and the Tea Party, who was the Tea Party poster boy, is doing abysmally in the polls. What is behind?
He has been literally trumped, in fact.
Absolutely trumped.
Yeah.
What is behind the Trump is something that has not been clearly thought about, neither by the pundits nor by the media. And the media, as you pointed out very well, Ivo, they feel that the club is coming to an end. And that, I think, is what is happening with American politics. And every expression of that club, including the two patrician journals you referred to, are having a very hard time, understanding what is going on.
Goldberg, of course, is not without a record for having written some fairly foam-flecked things of his own. But there was a phrase I loved in the piece he wrote in which he said of Donald Trump, and you could possibly apply the same to Jeremy Corbyn's elevation. He called it catharsis masquerading as principle, venting and resentment, pretending to be some kind of higher argument, which is a nice phrase and I think quite a resonant one. But Ivor, is it likely to persuade many Donald Trump voters, do you think?
I just wonder how many Donald Trump voters read.
Of course not.
National
Review. Read this or read anything.
I'm not going to go that far. I do think there is a culture war going on in the Republican Party, and this reflects it. There are three Republican parties for me. There is the traditional, if you like, I always think of it as the traditional, almost new George H.W. Bush, traditional conservative, but not far, centre-right. And then there were the insurgents. In this case, it was the religious right, which then led into the Tea Party. And neither of those seem to me, if you look at the last two presidential elections, could put together a majority. And Trump is actually coming from outside the party, and he's trying to appeal to the 40% of Americans who don't vote. He's trying to appeal to, I suppose, the Tea Party wing and so forth. And he's appealing to Democrats who are uncomfortable for one reason or other with the Democrat Party. So I think what we're seeing is a reconfiguration of the Republican Party. Whether it will be any more successful remains to be seen. But I think we're living in very interesting times, not dissimilar to the reconfiguration we've been talking about earlier with the British Labour Party.
Oscar, where does a magazine on the Liberal side like the New Republic fit in that reconfiguration? I mean, I guess I'm asking you, what is the role that a magazine like that can now play? Should it be trying to win converts or just shoring up the converted?
Well, it should be self-critical because, in fact, those who are behind this, political earthquake are looking for their information online. They're producing their information elsewhere. They have nothing to do and will want to have anything to do with this media. Let me also say, against your usual identification between Corbyn and Trump, that Trump is clearly catharsis-driven tragedy. But if that is the case, then Corbyn is more theater of the oppressed. And there is an important difference there, which speaks to the kinds of venues and audiences that people like Bernie Sanders and or Carson Trump are...
Well, I was going to say, there is the similarity. It's a cliche now, but it's not all cliches are wrong. The anti-politics mood,
yes,
articulated in Carson now closing in on... Trump, on Bernie Sanders. I mean, who would have thought that Hillary Clinton's main challengers would be somebody, a self-declared socialist in America? Hmm. So there's a big anti-politics mood. However, we've seen anti-politics moods before. We've seen the Ross Perots in American politics. Do the old machines reassert themselves? That's the interesting
Who thing. Knows? But of course, Sanders is not Perot, Trump isn't either. And
Trump's got a lot more money than even Perot had.
Absolutely. And the context is different. This is the thing. We tend, in these debates, we tend to concentrate on the figureheads. what about the people who are, you know, behind the rise of these figures, the people that Sanders talks to in halls across America? We need to know more about them.
Final thought from you on this, Ivor. For magazines like The New Republic and National Review, now that so much political debate is had among the somewhat reflexive hurly-burly of social media, should they rise above it or participate in it?
Oh, I think they have to participate in it. I mean, I think what's happening at The New Republic is quite interesting, that they're trying to make it a brand, a content, doesn't matter how you...
So this was after their newsroom bloodbath of last December.
Indeed. And the jury's still out on that. But if I think about the British context, where our two venerable political magazines, Spectator on the right, New States on the left, both of which have taken quite, I would say, quite enthusiastically online, and the Spectator has a blog, and the New Statesman has a blog, and quite a lot of intelligent debate happens there.
Indeed so. They're both the staggers at the New Statesman and at the Coffee House, Spectator. They are both really good. But finally tonight, we do know that the 2016 Olympic Games will be held in Rio de Janeiro, and we also know that the 2020 Games will be held in Tokyo. We now have a 20% understanding of where the flame will be lit in 2024, because a shortlist of five potential host cities has been announced. They are Los Angeles, Hamburg, Rome, Budapest, and Paris. At this early stage, Paris is the bookmaker's favourite, Budapest the rank outsider. Oscar, should we assume that it's been decided that it's Europe's turn?
Well, this is clearly a reaction to what happened with the Winter Olympic Games. We're talking about
the games
before.
Nobody wanted
those games. So the IOC thought, okay, let us preempt that by kind of offering the games to some cities. And it seems that they would prefer to go to America and or Europe. America seems to be their first and most preferred option, Los Angeles. But the bookies might be right. Paris makes sense.
I think there's a more logical, there's an easy explanation. It's the Northern Hemisphere's turn. It alternates between the Southern Hemisphere and the Northern Hemisphere. I'm desperately trying to remember who's 2016, I don't need to remind you, is Rio, so that's the Southern Hemisphere's turn.
2020 is Tokyo, which is Northern Hemisphere, but a different bit of it.
Yeah, that bango's another theory. However, I do think that there's a bigger issue, which the whole of the Olympics have become so bloated and gloated and economically disastrous, even for the quote, if you look at the quote, successful London Games, the legacy has rather disintegrated. I don't know what's going to happen with Rio, but I do think that this is time to, it would be great to have a rethink, but there's too much money involved. The sums are phenomenal. And the Olympic movement makes billions on it, and it ain't going to stop yet.
Oscar, Ivor mentions the bloat and the bureaucracy, and it was aspects of those which put off the four cities which bailed out of the 2022 Winter Olympics, leaving them to choose, I think, between Beijing and Almaty. And they eventually gave it to Beijing, at least because I think they knew where that was. Should the IOC, or is it, I'll put it another way, a slightly fate-tempting question, is it likely that the IOC will have absorbed any lessons from the unfurling FIFA debacle?
No.
We've still got 90 seconds, Oscar. I was hoping for a longer answer than that.
Look, I mean, Ivor nailed it. This is a money-making machine, and as far as the money keeps coming, and the money comes from television and also sponsorships and so on and so forth, they will keep at it.
A mild intervention on behalf of the International Olympic Committee. I wouldn't go as far as say they cleaned up their house, but after Salt Lake City, it is less corrupt than FIFA. Now, that's a pretty low bar. But they are definitely less corrupt.
It's just like saying they are less wet than water.
I would love to see that ranking.
Is there also, can we infer still a certain uneasiness about the Beijing experiment, in that these five countries or these five cities are all very much cities in established liberal democracies?
Can I just question liberal democracy? We've got Budapest here. I mean, are the Syrian Olympic team going to be allowed to compete?
Well, you make a not unreasonable point. Budapest could be a very different place by 2024. Who knows? Yeah. But Oscar, do you think there is anything in that they've got a bit more worried about the PR implications of where they choose?
Not sure. I would like to think that is the case, but the cynic in me tells me that that is not necessarily the case. I would say that they are favoring the fact that you have infrastructure, telecommunications, and so on, and they're more readily available in the West than elsewhere.
We will have to leave it there. Oscar Guardiola Rivera and Ivor Gaber, thank you both very much for joining us. That is all we have time for on this edition of Midori House. It was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Federico Romaniello. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, Josh Fennett is here with Monocle's International Playlist. At 1900, you can hear Daniel Giacopelli hosting The Entrepreneurs. At 2200, I'm back with the Monocle Daily, co-hosting with Thomas Lewis in our Toronto bureau. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow at 1800 London time. But for this edition, it's goodbye, and thanks very much for listening.